As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by our friends at Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined, as always, by my colleague from The Athletic, Stuart Mandel. Stu, we got a lot to talk about, even though the season is now over by a week plus, but this coaching carousel took a big turn. It wasn't shocking, but some huge news out of Knoxville. You and I have both written quite a bit about it. You led your mailbag with it today. I did a big story about how the Vols coaching search will proceed. Tell me, when they had that press conference with the chancellor of the school, the president, and Phil Fulmer, who's still technically the AD for a little longer, what struck you as interesting?
You know how, like, there are certain press conferences that have taken place over the years that you never forget certain moments from? I think Phil Fulmer being asked how, and it was our own David Ubbin who asked him, like, how will Jeremy Pruitt's tenure ultimately be remembered? And he said, well, recruiting was certainly good. It's going to be remembered for a long time. Because they literally handed out 40 pages, they handed out a report about just how illegal and dirty their recruiting was under Pruitt. And they fired the assistants who were, directly implicated, but also like their entire recruiting staff.
Nine other staffers, including two on-field coaches, were fired in addition to Jeremy Pruitt. It was kind of mind-blowing to see the chancellor of the school talk about level one and level two NCAA violations, which are very serious. So obviously they want to fire Jeremy Pruitt after three really kind of dismal years. And this, they hope, would get them out of paying him $12 million, but at the cost of which is going to, now whoever, and we saw how screwed up their last coaching search was that got him Jeremy Pruitt and got Phil Fulmer back into power there in Knoxville. But now you have an NCAA dark cloud that's going to be hanging over it. I mean, the speculation of what could come is going to be really rough. I mean, this was not, like, you and I have covered the sport for long enough where we remember when Tennessee was a powerhouse. Mm-hmm. That was a long time ago. You know, Butch Jones had 2 years where they finished in the top 25. Beyond that, they haven't been even close to good for a long time now. Like, there aren't players who they're going to be recruiting who remember Tennessee when they were a powerhouse. You know, they just remember Tennessee from, I'm not even sure how many of those kids are going to remember Fulmer as a coach. They probably, don't associate Lane Kiffin with it. They might remember the god-awful Derek Dooley years, but so I did a story on how I thought the search process was going to play out. I don't see how they could hire Hugh Freeze, no matter how much Hugh Freeze wanted that job.
They made that pretty clear.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how they could do it, even if Tennessee, by the way, which on that press conference, they talked about integrity and how important it was for that, while they saluted Phil Fulmer. It was just kind of seemed like a very farcical tone, as you referenced the Fulmer comment to Ubben.
Before we get into the coaching search, do you think they got so we've all been hearing or operating under the assumption for some time now that once they started this, and by the way, wasn't it like the NCAA came into town, you know, looking for damaging info? They volunteered it. It's exactly what you said earlier, right? They really want to fire him, and they want to fire him for cause. So they opened this investigation to get the goods. Based on what you were saying before, do you think they got in too deep? Like, they didn't realize when they started this just how much they were going to uncover, and now they're gonna hire a new coach who's got a rebuilding job to do regardless, and now that new coach may be facing major sanctions based on what they've uncovered.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure anybody can say with certainty at this point of that. I mean, one of the things, you know, I've heard from multiple people is that some of the violations that they've uncovered really seem brazen, and I think things that may have turned up in text messages and things like that are things that are almost impossible to work around if you're looking at them, and if you're, as you said, looking for them. So I don't, you know, it's
an interesting nugget from her press conference was that she said, the chancellor said, it started with a tip. I believe she said an in-person tip from a credible source, a tip to her office. So not like they didn't call the compliance office. They didn't call, the NCAA. They called the chancellor of the school, and it kind of went from there. And yes, like they didn't give any details, but the details are certainly circulating around at how brazen this was. Though, let's clear up something. To best of your understanding, and I know the answer, were there or were there not McDonald's bags full of cash?
I have not heard that from any sources that I would trust on.
Because it's taken on a life of its own already. Like the Florida basketball team clobbered the Tennessee basketball team, and the Florida basketball team put up a tweet, you know how everybody trolls now, that said, "We're loving it." Like, McDonald's is now accepted as fact. And I don't think it happened. I think some bad stuff happened. You got to be pretty dumb. Like, first of all, I'm not naive.
Before you go too far in this, and this is fine if it's in the podcast, but like when you start out a sentence with "you got to be pretty dumb" as if you're going to be very cynical, be careful, because who knows, like, what, you know, there may not have been McDonald's bags full of cash, but if there were text messages about this on university phones, then you're right. Then, you know, just, I don't know.
Oh, I think it's going to, the stuff that's going to come out is going to be like Ryan McGee from ESPN, who, you know, Tennessee guy.
Knows Tennessee better than, I would say Ryan McGee knows Tennessee football better than anybody who is writing about it. Ryan McGee has some pretty, he was a former Tennessee student manager, was close to Johnny Majors, who's obviously a Tennessee legend and former coach there. When he was a student assistant there. And so he has a pretty unique perspective.
He does.
On the whole.
And he tweeted, so you just established his credibility.
Yes.
He tweeted, a friend of his said, "We're so stuck in the 90s that even our cheating is based on blue chips." The famous movie, the famous basketball movie about a coach who starts buying recruits. Yes, you're right. Like, here's an amazing stat from one of our editors, Matt Brown, that he tweeted the day of the announcement. Since 2008, Tennessee is tied for 75th in the country in winning percentage, 488. So below 500 since 2008. From 1930 to 2007, all those decades leading up to it, they were fourth. They had the fourth best winning percentage in all of college football. 75th since then. I do think that with the right coach, with the right leadership, which they haven't had for a long time, Tennessee is a program where you can win a lot of games. But they're going to have to get out of their own way. They're going to have to get everybody on the same page, and they're going to have to fire the right coach. And so you were going to bring up the coaching search. What stands out to me in reading your article about the candidates and just basically, I started looking at who has been hired to this point. And I don't know that in this coaching carousel that there just haven't been many where you're like, oh, yeah, that's a home run. Great. That's cool. Woo, they nailed that, right? Like, I don't know how to feel about Brian Harsin at Auburn. I don't know how to feel about Shane Beamer at South Carolina. Maybe those guys will be good. But it's not like you don't feel the way about those hires that you did, you know, after certain ones in the past that have worked out well. If Tennessee can hire Jamie Chadwell from Coastal Carolina, Tennessee guy, Tennessee native, played at East Tennessee State, I'd feel really good about that.
Yeah. I mean, look, to me, he's probably the most sensible, realistic name that I think Tennessee could bring in. Assuming he, now again, I would think he wants it, but again, what are you getting yourself into? If you're Jamie Chadwell, you've done a really good job. There is going to be a lot of jobs that are expected to come open in 2021 after this season. In all likelihood, you probably have a better chance to win than if you go take a Tennessee job where, you know, heavy NCAA sanctions seem to be in the near future because of a bunch of level one and level two violations. Now, I'm sure at some point people will say if Jamie Chadwell or whoever, Lance Leipold or Will Healy or Bill Clark from UAB ends up with the job, people would say, all right, well, they took the job. All the people who did the cheating, they're gone. Why punish the new coaches and the players? But that's what the NCAA does, because that's about the only way the NCAA can punish a program and a university. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, because I think of all the people that, you know, I wrote about, I think those guys are the most viable. It's just if you're them, especially if you're Jamie Chadwell, Will Healy, where your guys in your early 40s or younger, you may get a shot at a Power 5 job. Do you want it to be one where you could have limited recruiting scholarships, probation, where you have all sorts of restrictions? You're probably not going to play in a bowl game for a couple of years. If it's, you know, and if it's really bad, it could be more than that. We don't know. And the thing is, they don't know. When Lane Kiffin left Tennessee the first time, left Tennessee, whatever it was, 10 years ago for USC, nobody had any clue USC was going to get hammered the way it was by the NCAA. You really can't predict just how severe it's going to be. But if your chancellor is openly talking about level one and level two violations, and when you fire 10 people on the staff, that speaks to a real problem. So that's why I think, you know, these guys, I'm not saying they wouldn't take it, but I think it's going to take a big, big leap of faith, because it's going to be an uphill climb. And by the way, you know, now Kevin Steele's the acting interim coach who, you know, by the way, that was a guy that also...
That's a whole other story.
It is, but like Phil Fulmer, that was another guy he almost hired. Like the three finalists were Jeremy Pruitt, Kevin Steele, and Mel Tucker. And he ended up on Jeremy Pruitt. Obviously, that was a disaster. Kevin Steele now is the interim, which, again, as you said, this is a whole nother dynamic. But the idea that players won't bail out of here now because, you know, honestly, at this point, why wouldn't they if you're looking at, you know, no postseason and who knows where this thing is headed? You know, that's like, I don't know. It's hard to paint a very rosy picture for Tennessee football when it's been so bleak for the last decade, and now you got NCAA issues on top of it.
I think if you're a coach who has leverage, who has, like, Billy Napier has already turned down some SEC opportunities. So I don't know why this would be the one he would sign right. on for, right? Given everything you just said.
Without NCAA issues hanging over them, Billy Napier said, no, I'm good. I like where I'm at. Let me wait to see what else comes over.
Right. So I think it's going to have to be, so the circumstances are unique with Jamie Chadwell in that he might just feel a lot of allegiance to that state and that program, and he would be willing to overlook those things. I mean, look, the good news is, if you take that job, is expectations are going to be a little bit lower at first, knowing
are
the
they
mess
though?
That you're inheriting.
Are they? It's Tennessee. I think
they have to be. I mean,
come on,
for all the reasons you just said, they're going to get hammered.
Yeah, you know what though? I think whenever we say expectations are a little lower, we underestimate or maybe we overestimate the people who make who do the firing and hiring. We all thought that there would be hardly any movement and people wouldn't pay a lot of, you know, didn't have the money to pay to get guys fired. Well, Will Muschamp has learned otherwise. They paid a lot of money to get rid of him. Gus Malzahn, they paid a ton of money to get rid of him. And because Tennessee doesn't have a lot of money right now, you know, they jumped into an investigation and who knows what that's going to cost them in the long term, but to get rid of Jeremy Pruitt after 3 years. So I think, you know, what you're saying practically makes some sense, that maybe there will not be realistic expectations. You got to give the guy. And what I think that will mean is whoever takes the job, instead of getting a 5-year deal, will probably get like a 7-year deal. But yeah. If that coach goes in there, and again, they may not inherit much, because whatever Jeremy Pruitt left behind, I have no idea how many of these recruits that signed there, 6 weeks ago, are going to be bound to it. They may be bailing for other alternatives, and then all of a sudden you have a depleted roster. Also, by the way, who knows how many of these players? If 10 staffers got let go, are some of these other players potentially compromised that they may be in some their own hot water?
Oh yeah, she alluded to that players are going to be ineligible.
Yeah, so then, you know, look, I'm just saying, if you take this job, you could be looking at a really, really depleted roster, and at the end of the day, Tennessee fans with its 100,000 seat stadium and all these expectations, I don't think they're going to look at it and go, "Oh yeah, we went 4-8, 4-8, 5-7." We're hanging in there. I mean, they're going to probably end up paying on the back end of that.
Yeah, you're probably right, because now that I think about it, when Jeremy Pruitt got the job off of, I think Tennessee went 0-8 in Butch Jones last year in the SEC, there was definitely like the first year, there was a total, you know, we understand like it's going to be bad. But by year two, when they lost to Georgia State, like they were ready to fire him then. So you may be right. I also don't know that these NCAA sanctions, I mean, we don't even know the allegations yet. We're totally guessing at how severe or not severe the sanctions would be. USC.
Well, we're guessing, but she spoke about it in detail on the record at a press conference.
I know, but it's been a long time since the USC sanctions were severe. That was a long time ago. We haven't seen the NCAA do anything close to that with a football program since then, other than Penn State, which was a very unique circumstance. And Penn State won a Big Ten title within a few years of that.
How many people, how many coaches at these places that you're talking about had 10 staffers get fired in the wake of a cheating scandal?
USC, they had one, right? Todd McNair?
They had one, yeah.
And he fought, and he's still fighting to say he didn't do anything wrong. Look, the details are going to come out. You and I both heard rumblings of it, of what they really were. They are pretty brazen. They're going to come out, but it'll be, you know, with the NCAA, it'll take years for them to resolve that. That'll be the other thing. Do you want that hovering over you? Like, you might not have scholarship reductions or bowl bans right from the beginning. I don't know. Interesting times in the SEC, by the way. This thing has become so explosive that it's like you almost forget, oh yeah, LSU banned itself from a bowl game last year because a player's dad got, you know, an insane amount of money. Florida basketball's trolling Tennessee on Twitter. Their own football coach, Dan Mullen, got a show cause like 2 months ago. There's a lot going on.
It just means more, Stu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, we wanted to get into the mailbag. It's something that we unfortunately neglect sometimes during the season, certainly the night of the national championship game. But we want to make it a central part of our off-season podcast. So as always, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We start out with a familiar name, Johnny Shea. It's interesting. This is not really a question, but it'll allow us to get into another big news story that happened since the last podcast. Hi, guys. Love the podcast as always. When Urban Meyer turned down my Longhorns, he said, "It's not you, it's me." Well, the news of his engagement to the Jaguars, as his jilted ex, I say, "It was me, it was me." which is funny. Okay, you, Bruce, you worked with the guy all season. I'm not saying he spilled all his secrets, but why do you think Texas, he did not ultimately take the Texas opportunity, but he did take the Jaguars opportunity?
Stu, I really think it came down to this. I don't think he was very intrigued by being a college football coach at this stage of his life. I don't think the name, image, and likeness stuff that's in the pipeline, I think that gives him more pause, probably more so than any football coach I talk to. I think he, in the way he sees the power structure in college athletics, I think that is a big concern to him. Then there's a level of unknown, I think, of how the NIL stuff will play out. So there was that. The NFL has intrigued him for a little while. I know he has gotten closer to the Cons, who own the Jaguars, over the past year. I did a story about Urban taking the job, I think it was last weekend, and kind of outlined some of the stuff I knew in terms of timeline on The Athletic about, you know, he'd met with Shad Khan, the owner of the Jaguars, multiple times on his yacht, Khan's yacht, not Urban's. And I also think, when you look at it, tons of cap space for the Jaguars, the first pick in the draft, a bunch of picks in the first 45 picks that they have this year. So I think there was a chance he saw it as, this was a franchise that went 1-15, to flip it in a relatively quick amount of time. Also, and this came up a little bit because I knew that the Chargers had some interest in him, and obviously we know Justin Herbert had a terrific rookie year, and there was some elements there that I think would be promising. I actually, from everything I know about Urban Meyer, I just think he would rather live in Jacksonville, he and his wife, than take the situation with the Chargers. And I just think a lot of things lined up for him to the point where he felt like, you know what, if I'm ever going to do this and find out how I would do as an NFL head coach, it's a challenge. This is the time. I really, you know, we've talked about this on the podcast a little, and you and I have talked about this a lot. He was very engaged and very invested in our show, in our Big Noon Kickoff show on Fox, and much more so than I ever imagined he would be before I started working with him. And that's, you know, on our weekly conference call on Mondays, our 2-hour production meeting on Fridays, and then, you know, being around all day on Saturday. At the same time, he's a coach, and he's the ultra-competitive coach, and I think he missed that. Now, I always felt like it was, at one point, it was, I think it was like 70-30 that I thought he was going to stay, and then about a week and a half, maybe a week before he ended up actually taking the Jaguars job, it flipped to 70-30 the other way, that I thought he would leave, just from some of the stuff I'd heard from people who were pretty close to Urban about the conversations he had had, and that basically it sounded like, to people he really confided in on the football side, it sounded like he had kind of talked himself into why he felt like he needed to do this. So, Johnny, for you and all the other Texas fans, do not take it personally. I just think that this is all about him taking a shot at the NFL to see, and we have no idea. I'd ask you, Stu, you've covered him, and you've written about him a lot. take out the part about how Urban will deal with losing way more than he ever has in his coaching career as a head coach. How do you think he'll do as an NFL head coach?
Yeah, I know that's the question everybody wants people to answer. How can you, with any of these college coaches that go to the NFL, how can you possibly predict that? There's been no pattern to which ones have done well and which ones haven't. I will say I agree with what you said about if you're going to take an NFL job, this seems like a pretty ideal setup in that you have all the pieces in place, it would seem, to do that rebuild. But I don't know, like, will his, we always heard about how great a motivator he was in college with, motivating young athletes. How much does that translate to the NFL? How much, there's a lot more X's and O's in the NFL. That's something that I think in his later years of his career, he put a lot of faith in the coordinators to do. So I don't know. I hate to be a cop out. I do not know how he will do. I wanted to touch real quick, though, on something you brought up, the NIL concerns. Pete Thamel, our buddy at Yahoo, has on more than one occasion, I think, reported or tweeted quote anonymous quotes from coaches who are saying that you're going to see a run of college coaches trying to go to the NFL now for that reason. They are concerned or scared of what it's going to be like to coach in college in the NIL era. And I would ask you, A, have you heard the same thing? B, what exactly is scary? I know it's different. I've made my views on this known. Like, obviously, it's going to have a big impact. I just don't think it's going to be as drastic, have these drastic negative consequences that a lot of people fear. But I'm not a football coach. What are they most concerned about with NIL?
I don't think it's as doom and gloom as that, at least from the coaches I talk to. Now, take Urban out of that. Matt Campbell could have gone. Pat Fitzgerald, those guys could have gone. Those guys were hot commodities. Dan Mullen, I don't think there was interest in him in the NFL to go. But the guys who I think could have gone, they didn't go. So, it's not to say... I know Pete talks to coaches too. It's not to say there aren't some of those who think that, but the ones who I think could have gone didn't. It's not to say that those guys may not, some of those same guys may not go 3 years from now, but like Ryan Day, there's interest in him. He didn't have interest. Lincoln Riley, interest in him, didn't have interest. So, I think, the concerns that I've heard, and there's a coach I talked to, I guess it's Tuesday night, it was last night, about something else, and we got to talking a little bit about this. And this is a coach who I don't think has much chance to be an NFL head coach anytime soon. But he had talked a little bit about just the uncertainty of what the, as I referred to it before, is like the power structure, but it's just like, what exactly does this mean in terms of how will you balance a team structure and when there is an economic value on players? Will there be a certain level of, I don't know if discord is the right way, but, everybody in a team in college football is going to try to preach that they're all a level of on the same plane, whether they're starters or not starters. I think when money is into it, especially when it's money that is formal and above board, I think that their concern creates some I'm trying to think of what the right way to say it is. I don't want to say uneven, but like, I think that could add some entitlement. Now, look, some of that stuff already exists, though, with guys who came in as a 5-star versus guys who came in as a 2-star or a 3-star or whatnot. But I think it's a more formal positioning of that. And there's a lot of other stuff about, I think I had done a story on The Athletic, and it is early on, maybe pre-pandemic, early on last year, about some of the concerns that would happen with just third-party people being involved. And now there'll be more third-party people involved. And I think there was some coaches who were cynically looked at, probably about 2 months ago, USC put out a video, and our buddy Matt Leinart was actually in it, where it was like a movie premiere.
That was
and
bizarre.
It was bizarre. You know, obviously it's happening also in a pandemic, which I think probably was another thing that they probably maybe regretted a little bit putting it out like that. But I think, you know, one of the takeaways from some coaches on that was this is showcasing or maybe emphasizing some of the things that coaches kind of cringe about, that they're like, it's emphasizing the wrong things, where they, and again, I don't want to say that this is like creates a paranoia or a huge fear, but it's like, does it emphasize the wrong things that they want to emphasize? And so I think that's why that is.
Yeah, I get that about the, I definitely get the concern about like the locker room culture and the star players are making more money. You know, it's just like a pro franchise, right? Like LeBron James is making a lot more in than the 12th guy on the team or whatever. But so the closest parallel to what we all envision NIL being is the Olympics. And I would just ask these, like what these college coaches should do is call up somebody associated with like the U.S. women's soccer team and ask them, you know, like Alex Morgan is way more marketable than most of the other women on that team. Like she gets all the endorsement deals, blah, blah, blah. She's also one of the best players on the team. So like, does that create, ask them, like, does that create locker room dissension? Or if she's like a hard worker, and which I assume she is, and a good leader, does it all work itself out? Like, I don't know. I would think the thing they'd be more concerned about that will directly influence their ability to manage a roster is the transfer exception. I mean, if I were a college coach, who, you know, we're only a few years removed from the era when they could literally block the kids from going to certain schools. Now, then they lost that ability. And now there's, you know, when this exception goes through, like guys are going to try to transfer like crazy because they can play right away somewhere else. We're already seeing that this cycle. And that's going to make it harder to manage rosters. I could see that being something that drives somebody away more so than NIL. But I know it's the great unknown.
Next up, Stu, Brandon from Fort Wainwright, Arkansas. Stu and Bruce, in your podcast, immediately following the national championship game, you briefly mentioned the plight of being a defensive coordinator or coach in today's game. Do you foresee defenses catching up to offenses at any point, as they have in the past, by developing new schemes, or are we facing a self-reinforcing system where the best players and coaches will gravitate to the offensive side of the ball, leading to even more track meets with even higher average scores? Good question, Brandon. Stu, what do you think?
Well, I think that the cycle is such that the offense, it's not that the defenses can't catch up to whatever the latest craze is. Like, for instance, when Chip Kelly brought the offense he did to Oregon and caught everybody off guard, it took a couple of years, but eventually coaches figured out, like, oh, we need to combat that, like, frantic style of play or pace of play. You know, we need to rotate in more defensive linemen, or we need to recruit a different kind of athlete for this position. So you catch up to that, but then somebody comes up with the next thing, right? And I feel like that's what the cycle is going to be. Like, coaches will take a hard look at what Alabama did this year, what LSU did last year. And I'm not saying a catch up, but like, you know, start to make some adjustments. And then as soon as they do that, some coach is going to come up with the next thing. I just think that that's the cycle where the offense is always one step ahead of the defense, and the defense has to catch up. And between that and between, I mean, just quarterbacks, just the tremendous skill level we see of quarterbacks now. I do agree with Brandon that I think the best athletes, maybe in a previous era, they wanted to play cornerback. Now they want to play receiver. They want to be the next Devontae Smith. I don't think we're going back to 17-14 anytime soon.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I don't think that. But look, I think there's going to be a lot of kids who are going to want to be Devontae Smith. Devontae Smith probably would have been a terrific cornerback too. And I just think that is the direction of the game. And I think that's, honestly, that's what the rules are dictating. Also, linemen downfield, that sort of thing. And I think it creates, I think, a more exciting brand of football. And I don't know. I don't want to go down a TV ratings hole with this. But I think there's a piece of that. Next question, Stu, from Ian in Seattle, who, by the way, is a proud TCU grad, class of 2004. To me as a fan, college football lives on Saturdays and holidays like New Year's Day. Therefore, it's hard to be enthusiastic about a college football game on a Monday night in January. If the playoff is expanded, what is the broadcast plan? More Monday games in January? How could college football reclaim Saturday as college football's rightful home to make this event feel special to the fans of the sport, not just the teams in it?
Good question, Ian. I've heard, it's interesting, I've heard more complaints about Monday night after this past game than I ever had in the past. And obviously this game had a record low rating, and there's a million reasons why, but like, I think the reason it's always, not always, but for a long time now, been on Monday nights is Monday night football, right? People are in the habit. It's not like playing a big football game on a Monday night is a new thing. Now it's usually the NFL. But a lot of games have been played on, championship games have been played on Monday night and gotten great ratings. So I don't think there's any, like, first of all, they don't really have a choice. They can't, especially now that wild card weekend is three games on both days. Like, there's no way you could put that on a Saturday once the NFL playoffs get started. So this is just me spitballing. I don't think we've reached the point of any big plans here. But if they expand the playoff, I would think it's going to happen earlier, not later. And the precedent was set this year, right? Like, we always used to hear, oh, we can't possibly make these guys play games during finals week in December. We did this year, and the world continued to spin. So that's when you could claim Saturday still, is I think like the Saturday, you know, that the Heisman usually is, and the Saturday after that, you know, you can still claim those. But you got to get those in before NFL playoffs start, because at that point you're squeezed out. And I have heard some people theorize, maybe you agree, that part of the effect of this year, why maybe it felt so pronounced on Monday, is the fact that there were six wildcard games, not four, and that maybe people are a little bit footballed out by the time they got to Monday night.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, again, I don't think I am the target audience. I'm going to, you know, gleefully watch it whenever it's on. I did feel a little bolstered that there were more games on New Year's Day, but I think this year, you know, when it happened, but I just feel like this year was such an outlier for so many reasons, as you alluded to. So I don't know. I really don't know how that kind of, you know, what you do on that. I do think the game is in better shape than probably some people, you know, make it out to be. I'm not saying it's perfect in the way it's structured. It is. I think there's still a lot of work that can be tweaked, but I don't know. I mean, I'm not put off by a Monday night game. I don't know if it's on Saturday night NFL playoffs or not. I don't think it changes anything for people. I just think if they're fascinated by the matchup, they would jump into it.
Yeah. People have been overreacting to, and I wrote about this in the mailbag, like, there's been a lot of doom and gloom coming off of that, and I just can't emphasize enough. This was such a weird season for so many reasons, and we saw the number. I mean, it wasn't like there was great ratings all year and then it tanked on that Monday night. Like, the ratings were low in the regular season. They were low throughout bowl season. It's not all that surprising the championship game did poorly, too. That doesn't mean that people are fleeing from college football. They just didn't feel invested in what kind of felt like if you were in the Pac, like if you were a Pac-12 fan and your team played four games all year, it's like college football season never happened. A lot of people didn't feel invested in this season and didn't feel the need to watch the championship game. And I'm not talking about, like, diehard college football fans will watch no matter where you put it, right? The way a big event like that, the difference between why in a big event like that gets 20 million or 20, you know, the difference in that number is the casual fans. The people, like, I'm a casual NFL fan, right? Like, I don't watch it that closely, but I watched a bunch of the playoff games this weekend. The equivalent of me for college is what determines those numbers at the end. And for many reasons, but I think most of them COVID related, there just wasn't that interest that there normally is in the championship game. I think, you know, the first year of the playoff, Ohio State, Oregon, that was on a Monday night and it got like 33 million viewers. So,
by the way,
too much into that.
By the way, also, ratings have been really low for pretty much every sport on a watershed moment kind of thing. They were low for the Stanley Cup Finals. They were really low for pretty much, I don't want to say everything else, But it's been kind of across the board.
It's right? been low for everything that was displaced from its usual time, like the Masters, like everything that was played at the NBA Finals. College football was played at its normal time at the end, but I mean, it started out, the Big Ten didn't play their first game until October 24th. So it just never, and by the way, I also think college football more than the other sports, like watching a college football game with no fans in the stands or with very few fans in the stands and with no band playing the fight song after the touchdowns, like doesn't feel like college football. I think that had probably more of an effect on college football than, you know, the NBA playing its games in a bubble. All right, finally, Justin Lyles in Oakwood, Ohio. I've actually been getting this question a lot. Now that the FBS season is complete, can you refresh our memories of what the spring FCS season is supposed to look like?
You know, Stu, I had this question myself, and I checked in with some FCS guys I know, and I was like, okay, you guys are actually playing the first game in like February 20th, February 21st. And so this is what I got back from a buddy of mine who is a FCS coach. And he said, we are playing then. The 20-hour work, we're right now in the midst of the 20 hours a week in terms of meetings and walkthrough and conditioning. He was like, fall camp, as in puts in quotes, fall camp for them starts on January 22nd, which as we're taping, this is obviously only 2 days away. Now, one of the issues, I think Indiana State opted out a couple of weeks ago, and I think there was some concern that that could be a trend. Maybe there's some concern of some other FCS leagues that may be 50-50 on playing. I think also what's significant, like one of the best conferences in FCS is the Missouri Valley, and you had a bunch of players, not just Trey Lance from North Dakota State, but their best offensive lineman. I mean, they already turned pro. Obviously, their best linebacker, Jabril Cox, went off to LSU. Lots of really good players ended up going and playing in the fall already. So I think it's going to be different, but it is still on track for us to have some FCS games. So I know, like you, we will be excited to watch them when they do happen.
Yeah, I mean, the good news for the FCS is I think it's going to get way more exposure than it usually does. It's the only college football on in this time of year. Outlets like The Athletic will have more time to write stories about them. So it could work. End up, you know, you hate the circumstances that led to it, obviously, but it could end up working out well for them. As always, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.